Shall we begin? That always does it. Okay, so last time we were talking about materials and structure. And one of the just inherent things about architecture is that if you're really serious about looking at it in a complete way, it's incredibly diverse range of issues. And some of them, as we saw early in the semester, have to do with kind of aesthetic, artistic things. And some of them, as we're finding out now, have to do with kind of technical engineering things. And we'll find out later in the semester that some of them have to do with kind of psychological, sociological things. So I'm well aware of the fact that there are some of you in here who are who identify more maybe with artistic, fine arts kinds of issues. And some of you in here are engineering students or science students, and you might identify more with technical things. And so I realize it's an incredibly diverse group of people in the class. So I just want to do a little poll here, just a little something for my edification. So last time we were talking about structure and materials. And I've got three options here. Number one is, you know, that lecture kind of sucked. I'm not that interested in that topic in architecture. I like some of the others better, but that one just kind of, I don't know, I just can't get my head around trying to figure out how a building stands up. Not my favorite part of architecture. That's one option. Second option is, you know, it's just like all the other issues. I mean, it's fine. I can, all of them are kind of equally interesting to me. Or the third option is, that was cool. That's what I like, the technical side of architecture. Really talking about nuts and bolts and how it works and how it's put together. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, how many people are the first option? Not so crazy about the technical thing. Raise your hand. Okay, that's good. How many people are the second option? It's the same, you know, really. Okay, how many people are the third option? I'm into this sort of tech. Dude, good, that's great. Okay, just wanted to know. Given the fact that today's lecture is kind of extending some of what we were talking about last time, talking a little bit more nuts and bolts. But before we go into that, let's read the Twitter card question answers from last time. So as you recall, the Twitter card question was, okay, think of a building where you can see, you can feel, you can understand how that building stands up and what it is that the building is doing in response to gravity and materials and so on. There were some great answers on that. So here are a few. My grandparents' home is a bending structure made of wood and lots of openings. The house feels thin and flexible, but has stood for 120 years. The frame allows for bending against the cold wind, but now it's creaking a little with age. And actually, that is so a description of bending, so that it actually is trying to bend at a joint, one piece against another piece, and that friction that's created by two pieces bearing against each other, that's what you hear when it creaks. Damn, good observation. Somebody else says, my church in San Antonio, St. Anthony Claret, is greatly characterized by structure. The thick stone walls of the bottom first story set a base for the church and greatly exaggerate the beauty of the thin, tall wooden framework above. The wooden frame's thinness allows for huge glass windows that illuminate the entire sanctuary during the day, giving it a very majestic, godly look. Somebody else says, in London, Westminster Abbey is built using large stones, and you can feel the compression and grandeur when you step inside. The building uses arches to hold up the massive structure. It makes you feel as if you are in the presence of the divine. Somebody else says, the Brooklyn Bridge is a good example of a building that expresses tensile stresses. We could easily imagine the tension running along the stay cables. You know, people know that bridge. It's a suspension bridge, two big towers. They're made out of stone. They're in compression. But across it is this cable that makes that beautiful, graceful, bridge form, suspension bridge form. And the whole roadway hangs from that. Yes, exactly. That cable is in tension. All those then cables that hang from it and hold up the roadway, they're all in tension. Great observation. Somebody else says, the house we lived in while in Scotland was a 200-year-old converted granite farmhouse. Granite had to be in compression, and the walls were almost 3 feet thick, so we had no cell phone reception inside. Yeah, thick, massive, no cell phone. The granite stone comes from the area where we lived, and the whole house was really historical and cool. Somebody else says, I think the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles is a good example of a bending structure. We saw that in that video on Frank Gehry. Underneath the surface, there is a massive steel skeleton that challenges the limits of the materials to balance tension and compression. The ability to create such a massive structure that still appears fluid and light is a true testament to the steel's complexity as a bending material. Somebody else says, the Eiffel Tower in Paris is famous because of its innovative structure. Its use of both compression and bending structures, a pyramidal-like shape and a steel frame, all allow it to be structurally sound enough to pierce the sky. It also does not hide the structure, exposing the strength for all to see. Exactly. I mean, it was designed by an engineer, Gustav Eiffel. Very, very famous engineer. And it was meant to demonstrate, damn, we got this new material, steel, which was brand new in the 1880s when it was built. Look what we can do with steel. And it was meant for a World's Fair. It was like a billboard for steel construction. And at first, people hated it. They hated it. What is this ugly skeleton? It's like there's no clothes on this thing. We don't like this. And so they intended to tear it down. Right after the fair was over, we're going to junk it, tear it down. It was good for demonstrating what steel's about, but we don't want a structure that looks like that. And then telecommunications came in. Marconi invented the radio wave. They put an antenna on top of it. And that was very, very useful. I mean, they didn't have to build the whole tower for the antenna, just put it on the Eiffel Tower. And so it stayed another 20 years as a telecommunications device. And by then, everyone fell in love with it. Just in love with this structure. It was nothing but structure, just steel, showing what steel could do. And it became beautiful in people's eyes. Somebody else says, Battle Hall is made up of many very large stone blocks that stack on top of each other. The use of compression creates a character of permanence and importance to the building that reinforces the function of the library above. Finally, this one's a really good one. Someone says, the Gherkin in London is a visual expression of the tumultuous winds it has to withstand. The whole structure is shaped like an oblong egg, with the steel reinforcing twisting and winding its way up the side. The curved shape of the building is very aerodynamic to help deflect the wind, while the curving steel reinforces the structure in bending. This one is it's a building. They call it the Gherkin, because that's what Brits call pickles. And it's shaped like a pickle, like a vertical pickle. And, you know, you could look at it and say, whoa, dumbass shape, you know, crazy. This guy's loaded. Crazy, crazy shape for a building. But in fact, it's all about structure. It's all about structure, about how it makes the wind go around the building instead of hitting it flat. If it hits it flat, that's more resistance it has to have to the wind. If the wind can go around it, it's less resistance. It's the reason why we make cars aerodynamic or we make boats hydrodynamic. in order to reduce the resistance to those loads. So that building is reducing the resistance to those wind loads. And then in addition, it's got a kind of diagonal structure that wraps around it, makes it look even crazier. But that increases the stiffness of the building. It reinforces it, just like, ribs reinforcing something. But and again, you can see the structure. It's very explicit. But excellent, excellent example. Okay, so that was about structure and materials. Today, we're going to go one step further. Okay, you've figured out how this building is going to be built. You know exactly what materials go in what places, and you're sure that the figuring out how to build it, how to construct it. And this is a huge part of architecture, because if you can't build it, and you can't build it economically, then it ain't going to get built. It's not going to get built. No matter how brilliant that structure might be, if you can't figure out how to build it and build it with some degree of economy, then it's not going to get built. So today, we're going to be looking at the whole idea of construction, how you make something, and tectonics, how it maybe expresses how that structure has been built. Let's think, how do we build buildings? In a very fundamental sense, how do we build buildings? And most of you, all of you, have seen a construction site. And actually, they're kind of interesting to watch. I'm absolutely enamored of construction sites. I can't keep my eyes off of them. When I pass by in a car or something, I'm always trying to see, what are they doing today? And right now, in downtown Austin, I live in a high-rise building, and I can see three construction sites from my windows, two to the south and one to the north. And I'm always watching, how you doing? You know, how's that working out? In my office downtown, there's one directly in the next block under construction. We have a hard time keeping our architects working. They're all out there at the window. Dude, look what they're doing today. You know, and because it's fascinating. How do you build a building? It's a fascinating process. So, how is a normal building built? And I would say that there are seven steps in how you build a normal building. Seven steps. Easy as pie. The first thing you do is site work. So you have to get the site ready for the building to be placed on it. And that will almost always mean some regrading of the topography. It will almost always mean some maybe changing out of some of the soil that you're going to have the thing bear on. So there's inevitably going to be some preparation of the site or site work as a first step. The second step would then be placing the foundation. And you might have a slab on grade where you're pouring concrete on top of that well-prepared site. You might be drilling piers down to bedrock so that then you're creating a hole and you're going to pour, make a steel cage in there and pour reinforced concrete down there to hold the building up, bearing on the stone that's down below, drilled piers. That's another kind of foundation. There are lots of different kinds of foundation. But a second step would be making the interface between the building and the ground, building a foundation. The third thing would be creating the structural system for the building. And that's exactly what we talked about last time. Maybe it's going to be bearing walls. Maybe it's going to be a steel frame. Maybe it's going to be wood stud walls. Whatever is going to be the bearing system for the building, the structural system, it's erecting that and putting it in place. So now we look out on the site. Now you see this, say, reinforced concrete frame coming out of the ground. You've all seen it. That's a stage of construction. Fourth step would be enclosure or skin. And maybe that's going to be a glass curtain wall around a high-rise building downtown. Maybe it's going to be wood siding on a house. Maybe it's going to be metal skin, maybe corrugated metal, maybe sleek metal panels. All of that would be the skin. And that involved in that is also thermal and moisture protection. So you're going to have some insulation in that skin. You're going to have some flashing and some waterproofing so that it'll keep the rain out. So creating the skin is not only something you see, but you also, there's the performance of keeping the water out and keeping the heat and cold where they ought to be. So that's a fourth step. The fifth step is then now we might go inside the building and start dealing with partitions. Not structural walls, but now we might go in and put things that are not load-bearing. And they're there to shape the bathroom or the closet or separate the kitchen from the dining room or in an office building, maybe create conference rooms and team areas and all kinds of other functional articulation of the building. Then a sixth step would then be to inject all the systems. So that's like you got to get the plumbing in there, you got to get the wiring in there, you got to get the heating and air conditioning ducts in there, all of this complex web of technology that we now demand in buildings. All of that needs to be woven into those partitions and plugs put in that stud wall and before the sheetrock goes on and putting the ducts up there before you completely enclose that with the sheetrock. All of that is done kind of in conjunction with the partitions. And then the seventh and final thing is then to put finishes on the building. It might mean just painting the gypboard walls. It might mean putting sort of fancier, more elaborate stonework on the outside of the building. Anything that is not structural and not sort of intrinsic to the building, it may be ornament or finishes that are put onto the building. So, seven steps in that process. Now, it's often not quite as linear as that. In particular, those buildings I'm seeing under construction outside my window, on the top floor, they may be just pouring the reinforced concrete frame of the building. They're at that structural system stage. But they did that structural system for the bottom floor, 3 months ago. So by now, they're already putting the plumbing and the wiring and everything into that part of the building. So often in a tall building, they start at the bottom with the structural system, but then as soon as that's complete, they move in and they start doing the next step and the next step and the next step. And while they're still building, just a frame at the top of the building. And they slowly move the building up in terms of its completion. So it's absolutely fascinating. It is a miracle that buildings get built, honestly. There are like one of those 30 or 40 story buildings that I'm watching outside my window. There will be thousands of people involved in that, literally. Maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people that will work on that building. And it'll take a year and a half, 2 years to complete that building. This is a mammoth investment of human time and energy. And everybody has to be coordinated. Somebody has to be told, today you're supposed to take this piece of material, trot it over here, install it there, go back and get another one, trot it over here. And somebody has to know what to do every single day. Thousands of people all over that job site. It's a really complicated and interesting process. And so humankind has been at this for a really long time, and we certainly build in a different way in our culture in the United States, where labor costs are very high than we would build if we were in Mexico, where labor costs might be a lot lower. We might be more dependent on mechanization in the United States. We might be more dependent on hand labor in Mexico. And that would be for economic reasons. So there's all kinds of other things that have to do with jobs and employment and that come out of the building process and how you're doing it. So it's a big, interesting, complex system, this idea of building. Now, there are normal ways of building, which is what we've just been talking about. And then there are innovative ways of building. We're always looking for ways to do this more efficiently, more effectively. And honestly, that's a lot the architect's job. Not just to figure out what are we going to build, but how could we do this more economically? How can we do this more efficiently? And there are a number of major innovations that have come maybe over the last 30 or 40 years, a lot of them having to do with prefabrication. And these days, a lot of it having to do with digital technology, with ways of going directly from the drawings to robotics, computer-aided manufacture devices that will actually just take the instructions that are in the drawings, the digital instructions, and they will just do it through robotics. And that saves a lot of labor. So that's being done more and more. There's a fantastic stone cutting operation just south of town here that has what's called a five-axis mill. It is an incredible robotic machine that cuts stone. This is what little craftsmen used to do with their hammers and their little chisels, chip, 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 and make that beautiful stone carving. Now there's this elaborate robotic thing that goes, and it's done, and it knows exactly where to go and what shape to make, and with this multi-axis, arms that do it. Completely different building process. And you can still go to some other countries and see the guys, chip, 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 chip. But honestly, here that costs an arm and a leg, and so we have other technologies for doing that. Now, that happens on a micro scale in technology development, but also happens at a macro scale. So I want to show an example here of where there was a challenge to building process, and a solution was arrived at by the architects and by the contractors that would solve this particular problem. So the problem they were given, San Antonio in 1968 had what they called Hemisphere. That was like half of a world's fair. It was just meant for the hemisphere of North and South America. The big world's fair, big deal for San Antonio. And they were building this whole fair ground, and it has the Venezuela pavilion and the Bolivia pavilion and the Chile pavilion and Mexico pavilion, the Canada pavilion. It has all that like normal world's fairs. And then it also has, all things, demonstrations by big corporations of what they're doing in the Americas, ExxonMobil, and things like that. So it's a big world's fair. Well, the city fathers and mothers had planned this thing for years, and then toward the end, it looked like, damn, this is going to be successful. This is going to be way cooler than we thought it was going to be. It's going to attract a lot more people than we thought it was going to attract. But wait, in San Antonio, we don't have enough hotel rooms for all those visitors that are going to want to come to Hemisphere. So here we are, like a year away from opening date, and we don't have enough hotel rooms. We got to build a hotel fast. Well, you don't build a big hotel fast. These things take time. So they go to a large contractor, Zachary Construction, in San Antonio, and they hire an architect, and they put the two of them together, and they say, fast. We need this fast. We can't wait for the normal amount of time for this to be built. So they put together a completely different building process. Very novel and very inventive building process. And what they did was they decided, okay, we're going to build all the hotel rooms, not slowly going vertically. We're going to build them all at once on the ground as little hotel room boxes. So they made them out of concrete. They had this on the right. You can see the formwork of that, these steel forms. And what they would do is they're right there on the ground. It's easy to get the concrete there. Talking about hoisting it 16 stories in the air, which is hard. No, we're right here on the ground. Just get the ReadyMix truck. It comes from the ReadyMix plant, and it just pours the concrete there. And every day they just, have a bunch of those forms, and they're pouring concrete in, and they're rapidly producing all of these identical hotel rooms. Because in hotels, the rooms are pretty much the same. So in the end, on the left, we can see that hotel room That's a little balcony out here, glass wall. We can see into the room. That little opening beyond there, that's the door, as if we were going out to the hall of the hotel room. Here we are with just lots and lots of those hotel rooms, all formed up on the slide on the left, and then all the forms are taken off. And what we're seeing here is each hotel room with its door. What we're seeing sticking out there is half of the hallway. So half a hall on this side, half a hall on that side. You can see the reinforcing bars sticking out. What they're going to do is twist those together in the middle of the hall, pour a little more concrete around them, and you have a complete surface for the hallway between the two hotel rooms. And they're completing them. See the slide on the left? They build that hotel room. They put the balcony on, the rail on the balcony. They put the door in. They put the carpet on the floor. They put the pictures on the wall and screw them in. They put all the toilets and everything's finished completely on the inside. Looks just like that. And they did it on the ground, and they did all of them at once. They didn't have to wait to do the 16th floor when we got up that high. They could do the 16th floor hotel rooms today, day one, and completely finish it out and do it fast and mass-produced and on the ground, so it's much, much easier. And so they're whacking away producing these hotel rooms out on a site outside of San Antonio. At the same time, down on the site in downtown San Antonio, they're building the elevator core for the building. So they're actually building it, you know, in a more conventional way. They did the site preparation, they did the foundations, and then they built this elevator core up, and they're putting the elevators in there. And that's being done while they're doing the hotel rooms. So you don't have to do it sequentially, you do it concurrently, all at the same time. And then they start stacking the boxes up. They just get a big crane, trucks come in, lift the box, put it on top of the other box, put it on top of the other box, put it on top of the other box. All the boxes are strong enough to hold the boxes on top of them, and they're just stacking them up in the air. And they're making the little balconies on the outside. In the slide on the right, you're seeing the hallway from the other side, the rooms facing the other direction, and you've got half the hallway there. And then they're putting these boxes in on the side nearest us, and they're completing the hallway with them. And in the end, you get the Palazzo del Rio, the Hilton Hotel in downtown San Antonio. They built the whole freaking thing in 9 months. They could sit around and have tacos for a week before it's time to open. They finished early because they did a completely different building process. But you can see also how the building process actually had a big impact on the design of the building. You can see all the little boxes of the hotel rooms, and they're kind of expressed in that. And now it's really an evidence of building process. Okay, so today we're going to look at the building process in some detail in three different buildings, in three different eras. And it's just to let you see all of the complications and the challenges and the issues that come in up when we're talking about building process. So the first one we're going to look at is a Gothic cathedral. It could be just about any Gothic cathedral. They were built in similar ways. But the one we're going to look at is Amiens, which is a high Gothic cathedral. This is the very end of the Gothic period. This is like the best, the most refined, the most elaborate Gothic cathedral. It's taller and thinner and lighter than just about any other Gothic cathedral. And that's what the challenge was for the people building the Gothic cathedrals. They were accustomed to building things low. All of their towns were like two or three stories tall. That was the maximum anybody built. And yet they wanted to build this cathedral where when you were inside it, you got this sense of going up to the heavens. They wanted this tall, tall space. And they wanted it to be filled with light because it's meant to remind you of God and divinity. And so you want this tall, thin space filled with light. And they knew how to build lots of little cubbyhole rooms and build two- or three-story buildings. But building this kind of structure required development of a lot of brand-new technologies that had not existed before. So they invented ways to build much taller. On the slide on the left, you can see the town of Amiens at that two- or three- or four-story height. and how much taller this building was. They had these huge compressive piers, stone piers in compression, as you can see on the right. We know how to make compressive form, but how do we get it way up there? How do we construct it way up in the sky where we can't reach? So that was a challenge for them. They also had the idea of this tall, skinny space inside, but they didn't want a whole heavy wall that was being tall and thin like that. If you just put a wall in compression, you'd have to make it super, super, super thick, and then it would be, and as you make it totally solid, because to carry all those loads, you'd need lots and lots and lots of stone. They didn't want that. They wanted the wall to have big openings in it so it could get lots of light in. So how do I make a tall wall but still keep the openings? And the solution to that was something they call flying buttresses. That's these things that actually take the loads from that wall, which is the wall of the interior, and spread it out to there. And they make a second wall that carries that load out there. And that allows the first wall, the inside wall, to be penetrated much more thoroughly and have big windows and get lots of natural light to the inside of the church. So here you can see those flying buttresses that are holding up the main wall of the church there, and then allowing that main wall to have those big windows in it. And that was a big innovation, was these flying buttresses. And so on the right, you can see those big, strong, now we're on the second layer of that buttress as it comes out, big piers. And in between the big piers, we have the big openings for windows. And on the inside, it is tall, thin, lightweight, big openings, exactly what they wanted to get out of it. And then at the top, there are these groin vaults. We talked about them a little bit in Hagia Sophia last time. They understood if we're going to build in stone and we're going to have compressive forces, we're going to have a vault. But that vault can go in two directions, and that makes the groin vault. But now, heck, we're like 250 feet up in the air. Ridiculous. How can we possibly build these elaborate groin vaults 250 feet up in the air and with nothing below them? How do we construct that? These are huge challenges. So building a Gothic cathedral wasn't just about conceiving what it would be like. It was about figuring out how the heck do we make it. So let's figure that out. You start with the foundation. And in the area in France where these were being built, there was very, very good limestone. Lots of stone they could go out and quarry. And there were different kinds of limestone. Some of the limestone was very dense and extremely strong, but also very, very heavy. And some of the limestone was not quite so dense and not quite so strong, but also not quite so heavy. So they start building at the base, and they build out of that denser, stronger limestone, which is a little bit darker color. As you can see here, this kind of darker color up to that point right there, it's this darker limestone. And then above that, it's this creamier colored limestone. The creamy colored limestone is not so dense and not so heavy. The dark colored limestone is much denser and much heavier. Now, when you're interfacing with the ground, and you've got the moisture of the ground, and you don't want the moisture to deteriorate the stone over time. And we're not talking about 10 years here. They're building for 1,000 years. They're building for the ages. So that stone can, limestone over time, can flake off if it's exposed to water continuously. There's a little bit of that happening actually in Battle Hall. In that limestone where they haven't detailed it properly, the limestone has deteriorated over the 100 years of the building because of continuous water. But if you get the denser, stronger limestone, it can resist that water. So they use the denser, stronger limestone at the bottom where it's interfacing with the earth and moisture. And then when you get up a little bit higher, they use the actually kind of more beautiful, creamier colored limestone. That is also easier to quarry, lighter, not quite so dense. And this is a building process issue right here. Look how much smaller the stones are when they're the heavier limestone than when they're the lighter limestone. And that's because human beings have to lay these things. And if they're heavier, we're going to make each stone a little smaller. And if it's lighter, we're going to make the stones a little bigger. It's the process of building that is informing the size of the stones that then informs the character of the building. So in a very practical way, we're figuring out how do we put what kind of stone where, how do we make the foundation. We kind of dig a hole in the ground. They put a crypt down there below the church. That's the foundation of the building. They make it out of this denser, stronger limestone in smaller pieces. And then you can see them lay up. Okay, now we're out of the ground. We're away from the moisture. Now we can use the lighter, less dense limestone. We can use bigger pieces. And we just bring it out of the ground, and we're building it up. And as in the slide on the left, you can see that scaffolding. So there's some trees around in France, and they build the scaffolding out of wood, and they build it up to a certain height, and they keep building the wall up and up and up. And so you can go about as high as is shown there, which might be about 45 or 50 feet with the wood scaffolding. And after that, they don't have trees big enough to make pieces of wood big enough to make scaffolding strong enough to go any higher. So you could say in a certain way, okay, dude, time to stop. You can't go any higher than that. And at the beginning of Gothic cathedrals, they did kind of stop when they got to that height. But no, we want more, higher, taller, thinner, lighter. So they've got to figure out a way, how do we go beyond that? And they invented this clever method of actually building the way to get the stone up there in the wall itself. So they make these little spiral stairs, like you see in the slide on the left, and they build it into the wall, and that's how they take the stone up to make the next layer. And then they build a little bit taller spiral stair, and that helps them build the next layer, and a little bit taller spiral stair, and that helps them build the next layer. And they could go all the way to heaven by doing that. But it allows them to go beyond that otherwise kind of artificial limit of what the scaffolding would do. Then, of course, they have to go out and have some platform to construct the next layer of wall. But you can't come down from the ground because you're too high. And so they have this system where they actually embed the scaffolding in the stone wall and cantilever it out. And that makes the temporary platform for them to build the next layer up. Now, so how many of you have been to a Gothic cathedral? It could be Notre Dame or Chartres or some Gothic cathedral. Raise your hand. Okay. Of those, how many people went up to the top of the Gothic cathedral? Okay. Usually, you go up to the top through these spiral stairs. They're still there. They were made for construction, and for many, many years, they would have just been useless, shut down. And then we began to have tourism. And people started going all over the world and seeing these Gothic cathedrals. And they want to see what it's like when you get up. So they open up the little construction stairs, and now that's how you go up there. Do you honestly think in 1200 they were designing a little stairway for you to go use your camera and take a picture from the top of the building? Hell no, they weren't. Those stairs were there for construction. They just happened to be able to be used later for us going up to the top and seeing what it's like at the top of the cathedral. If you look closely in Gothic cathedrals, you'll also see the little holes where those structures were placed in there. And many cathedrals, they didn't go back and plug them up. We can still see the remnants of how they built the building in the product that's sitting there today. Sometimes you might have a really big opening, a rose window or something like that. Okay, how can you attach the scaffolding to the wall if the wall is going to be an opening? Well, you build a big structure like the one on the right that carries you around, a scaffold that carries you around that rose window and allows you to build the rose window itself and the walls that support it. So now we're up out of the ground. We're able to go just as high as we need to go. We've got a way to bring the stones up and to get our material and our workmen up to the right place to do the right job. And then we begin to get this challenge of, okay, how do we put the roof on this thing? Now we're talking about building over nothing. And we can't build scaffolding up that high because we don't have the timber for it. We're getting these pieces for the trusses from Lebanon, from a really long way away, another part of the Mediterranean, because that's where they have trees big enough for these big pieces of wood. And but still, how do we, all right, we found the trees, we know we can make these big wooden trusses, the triangle things that are at the top, but how do we put that in place? And what they do is they prefabricate those trusses on the ground. They make all of the pieces, all of the right lengths and shape they're supposed to be. They make these mortise and tenon joints where they hollow out one piece of wood and make a tongue on another piece of wood, and the tongue fits in the slot, and then it has a peg that secures it. And so they do all that on the ground, and they make a perfect truss on the ground, and they assemble it. Then they disassemble it into pieces and take it up and reassemble it as a truss up at the top. So most of the work has been done prefabricated down at the bottom, and the minimum amount of work is done way up there in the air. But then how do you get it up there? Well, you see that little wheel on the right, and look at the scale of it in relation to the workman over there. If any of you have had a gerbil or a hamster in a little cage, and you have a little wheel where the little dude gets there and runs around, 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 this is exactly the same principle. You put a workman in there, and they just do hand over feet like this, and they get that thing rolling like this, and they go faster and faster and faster, and it turns a pulley, and that pulley lifts one of those big-ass pieces of wood up to the top, and that's how they make the truss. So they're having to invent all of these machines and devices for getting the things where they need them, and finally they get it up at the top. So how do they build these flying buttresses? Now they're way up in the air, but they're also a complicated shape. And of course, any kind of arch, like we talked about last time, it only works when it's complete. You take that keystone out, you take any one piece out, and it is structurally completely unsound. It falls down. So how they would build them is they would use what's called sittering or armature, this bow-shaped piece of wood, assembly of wood, and they would put it up there in the place where they wanted to build the arch or the flying buttress. And then they would, there it is, we're building it on the ground, we're taking it, installing it up like that, and then we're building the stone shape on top of that. And when it's all complete and all the mortar has set, then we take the piece of sittering or armature out, the wood piece comes out, we move it down to the next bay and we make another one. And when it's complete, we take it out, move it down to the next bay and make another one. And so it's super efficient. We're able to use that formwork over and over and over again. And that's why all of the buttresses are the same. It's efficient. It's building process that's telling them, do this over and over and over, because you're just going to make the formwork once and they're going to reuse it each different time. And it's impacting the design of the building. So there's an example of one of the buttresses completed. On the right, we see one of those pointed arches. They do them exactly the same way. And they have a wooden formwork down below, and they put the stone pieces on the top. And when it gets absolutely complete, then they take the wood piece off, and you're left with the perfect arch. Okay, that's arches, but what about these badass groin vaults? Man, those are gorgeous, aren't they? I love groin vaults. So these beautiful groin vaults, how do you build one of those? Well, like I said, we're way, way, way up above the ground. And they did a sort of divide and conquer mechanism. Instead of trying to build it all at once, you build arches. You build individual ribs. So you would use the same kind of sintering or formwork that we've been looking at right here. And then you would put an arch on top of it, this thing going like that. And you do that from all different directions, and you make the kind of web of the groin fault. And then you go back in and do infill in between those. And the way you do that is you use what are called stones. Well, the process was called stones. Of course, it's just stones, rocks. And you take a rope and you simulate the load of the eventual vault by pressing the rope against the stone that's existing there. So eventually, that vault is going to have a load pressing down like this. So that load pressing down like this is simulated by a rope that goes over like this. And that rope is then held with a stone there. So you put in a piece of stone, you put the rock on the rope around it, and it stays in place. And then you do the next one and put the rock on the rope outside that, and eventually you make the entire vault by simulating the loads of the eventual structure as you're building each piece of it. Well, clever way to figure that out. And then you can do it all from the top, not having to go from the bottom. So in the end, we use all those and 1,000 other devices they invented, and you get a Gothic cathedral. And it would have been an astounding thing for people at the time. People made pilgrimages from all over the world to go to see these Gothic cathedrals because they were spectacular. All of that would not have been able to happen if they hadn't had all these building process inventions. And still to this day, we go all over the world, from all over the world, to see these very same Gothic cathedrals. And the way they look, the way they are, has a lot to do with the actual construction process. Okay, so that's one building, Amiens Cathedral. Second building, this one is Santa Maria della Fiore, which is the cathedral in Florence, the main cathedral in Florence. And this one was built between 1296 and 1462. The Amiens Cathedral was substantially done by about 1288. There were subsequent things they did on it up to the 15th century, but it was substantially done by 1288. And that was considered kind of the high point of Gothic architecture. This one is started 8 years later down in Italy. And Italy at the time, we think of Italy as a real powerhouse in architecture, but at the time, Italy was not the cool place to be. Italy was not a cool place to be politically or economically or in terms of military or political power, and it was not a particularly cool place to be in terms of architecture. It was the backwater. The place to be was France and Germany. They were really cool in this 12th, 13th, 14th century time period. So only 8 years after they have substantially finished Amiens, the people in Florence start to build a cathedral down there. And they're doing it in what would have been called an Italian Gothic style. So it's the Italians who aren't very inventive in this era. They're just copycatting what the Germans and the French are doing. And they're building these. Gothic architecture was invented in France. They're copying the French stuff, and they're bringing it down to Florence. In another era, they would have been leading the world in Italy. But in this era, they're followers. So they start building this cathedral in 1896. And you see the dark walls in that slide on the right. They're building that part of the cathedral. It's got the nave down the center. It's got the side aisles on either side. You know, the idea is that they probably will put a transept, that means a perpendicular piece, at the end of it where the altar is going to be. And there'd be a crossing, and they do it just like a good Gothic cathedral. I mean, we know what a good Gothic cathedral looks like. It's got that transept and the crossing, and, like that. See on the left, the two pieces intersect, and that's where the altar is, where the two pieces intersect. And that's what you do in a Gothic cathedral. So they were thinking, okay, we'll do pretty much the same thing. We'll just copycat those frogs in France. So then something kind of astounding happens. In the very beginning of the 14th century, they heal a long-standing war that had been going on in Italy. There were two big families, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. And one reason why their economy was pathetic was because they just kept fighting wars. And all their energy was going into fighting wars, and they weren't getting any stability, and they couldn't get any economic growth. So they had a couple of centuries of just sucky economy because of these wars. And then in the beginning of the 14th century, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines made peace with each other, and the war stopped. And suddenly, they began to realize, we could build a really great culture here. We're good merchants. We have lots of good products. We could be much more powerful on the world market. So things start turning around. All the meantime, they're building this cathedral that we're seeing here. And then in 1350, they have a big, terrible infection. It's called the Black Death. You could sort of think of it as the Ebola of the day, only it was a hell of a lot worse than Ebola is. I mean, like in West Africa, what, maybe 4,000 people have died of Ebola? In Florence, 40% of the population died in Florence of the Black Death, all at once, just decimated the city. So they had been building this cathedral, they got that far, and they have the Black Death, and in 1350, everything shuts down. By 1367, they're recovering. The city's getting back on its feet. And now they're thinking, why should we do something that's Gothic like the French? We've got an economy that could really take off here, and we don't want to be like the French anymore. And there were people who could go down to Rome, and they were doing archaeological excavation in Rome, and they could see, like, the Colosseum, and they could see the Pantheon, like we saw last time. The Pantheon sitting down there in Rome. You make a little trip from Florence, you go see the Pantheon. You say, holy shit, look what they did. Look what we did. Look what our culture did when it was Roman times. And now we're going to copy the French? That didn't make any sense. We can do better than that. And so they got the idea in their mind, instead of a Gothic termination of this new cathedral, they were going to have a dome. And they knew you could build a dome. They could go down in there and see the Pantheon. We know we can do that. We know it works. We just don't know how. We don't know how to get all that stone up there. But they determined they were going to make a dome at the end of this cathedral. So some drawings were made. And by about 1400, they'd scrapped the whole idea of the Gothic termination. And they said, okay, we're building a dome, definitely. And they put in the foundations for a dome and for that dome shape. They didn't know how they were going to build it, but they had enough faith, they put in the foundations for a dome. And so then in 1418, they still haven't figured out how to build this dome. Now, there are several things that they kind of could figure out. They knew this much about domes. That one option was to make semi-domes like this that would start to hold up that big dome. They could look at something like Hagia Sophia. We saw those semi-domes holding it up. So that was one option they could think about. And then there are all these buttresses. Yeah, it's like flying buttresses, but they were making them kind of not like Gothic ones. And so they're building at the bottom here, and they're building up, and they're building all these flying buttresses and semi-domes, thinking, okay, that's going to help us carry all the loads from this dome, and we're going to figure out how to do it. We're going to figure out how to build that final big dome. But still, you know, not there yet. And it seemed kind of half-assed. This buttress stuff, that's kind of like Gothic architecture. And the semi-domes, do we really have to have semi-domes? Couldn't we? We just want a dome standing up there like the Pantheon does. So in 1418, they have this competition. And they invite anybody who wants to submit an entry for how to build the dome. They built a scale model of the church with the dome, and they put it inside the part of the church they'd already constructed. And it was big enough that people could actually walk inside this scale model and see that badass dome. So it was like maybe 12 feet tall. And you could walk inside and see what it's like. Everybody fell in love with it. Absolutely. Got to do it. So they have this competition. There's a lot of publicity about it. People all over the countryside come in, submit for this competition. There's one entry to the competition which I think should have won. It did not win, but I should tell you about this one. Very clever idea. One guy had the idea that you will take, so they built this much. They built the nave up to that point right there. And they built this much around it, all the claptrap of those semi-domes and buttresses. But they don't have any dome in the middle. And so one guy had the idea, what you do is you take dirt from all around the countryside and you fill the entire dome space with dirt. And then you build a dirt mountain exactly that shape. And then you build it on top of the dirt mountain. Perfect. It's easy. And then the question came up, well, then how do you get the dirt out afterwards? He said, I got it. I got that taken care of. What you do is, as you're putting the dirt in there, you put coins in the dirt. And the Florentines are so greedy, and they love money so much, they'll figure it out, because they'll want to get those coins. So that seriously was a proposal. Pretty clever. I mean, I think that's cool. But that one didn't win. So the one that won was the entry by Filippo Brunelleschi. And Filippo Brunelleschi had lived in Florence all his life. His father had been one of the people working on the cathedral, so he knew it very well. And he was a very great architect. He's often referred to as one of the two fathers of the Renaissance. And this is where the Renaissance was born, right here in Florence. And this building was absolutely essential in the beginning of the Renaissance. It was looking to Greece and Rome and saying, yeah, we can do that. We can do something better than this Gothic claptrap that the French have been doing. We can go back and recapture the grandeur of Roman architecture. And part of that was building domes. So he had, in his entry, a four-step process. The first step was to divorce the dome from all of this junk they'd been building around the outside, the semi-domes and the buttresses, and to put it up on a tambour right there, this vertical thing, so that it sits above everything else. And that tambour would be like a drum that the whole dome would sit on. So that was the first idea. The second idea was that you would, in many ways, like we were talking about with groin vaulting, you would divide and conquer. You would build ribs, big arches that went across the domed space. So you would build 8 major ribs, as you can see here, and they're articulated on the outside of the building. The construction of the building is expressed on the outside in those 8 ribs that were absolutely essential for building them first, and they're not so heavy or so hard to do. You can do one rib. You can't build the whole dome, but you can maybe build and support the weight of one rib, and then another rib, and then another rib, another rib, and you get the 8 ribs. And then in between the 8 ribs, you put 2 small ribs between each large rib. So 2 more between each of the 8 ribs, and that makes 24 ribs all the way around it. And so now you've got a framework to make the dome on. So the first idea was the tambour or drum. The second idea was to make the ribs or the framework. The third idea was then, instead of building one dome, you make 2 domes. And each dome is half the weight, but then they're connected together to get the maximum strength. So first you build an inside dome like that, and it's not so heavy, and it's supported by all those ribs. And then you build an outside dome like that, and it's also not so heavy. And then you connect the 2 together, and then they're super strong, and they're able to do the job. So it's, again, a kind of divide and conquer by doing 2 domes. And in between those domes is actually the workspace. That's where all the workmen go to carry the stone up and to take their materials in and out every day. And to this day, you can go between those 2 domes of Santa Maria Della Fiore, and you can see where all the construction was done and where the workers were. Anybody gone up to the top of the dome of Santa Maria della Fiore? Yeah, three or four. That's cool. It's cool, isn't it? Look at the TAs. They've been there. Yeah. Okay, so that space is in there between the domes. Now, if you go to Florence, you've got to go see Santa Maria della Fiore. And if you go to see Santa Maria della Fiore, you need to walk up to the top of the dome. It's not easy to find it. You have to go around to the back and, you know, find the little guy and get up. And so, no, that's out there when you go to Florence. So then you go up. There's a little museum on the way up of all their tools. And finally you get to the top. And you can go out on that little platform. Okay, so the first thing was the drum. The second thing was the ribs. The third thing was the double dome. And the fourth thing was these chains that are used like girdles to pull the building together. So they would make holes in the stone here, and they would put a chain in there. They knew that chains could take tension. Yeah, that's what that was a device they used, just like we use chains now to pull things. So you put a chain all the way around there in a couple of different spaces, and then you put grout or concrete in that. And then you lay the next layer up, but it had all these chains, so it's like a girdle that holds the whole thing in. So any thrust that might want to push that dome out, now it's all held in that tambour. And that, as a building process device, was the way they, you can see another one here and another one here, and it went all the way up the dome. And again, in the end, we get this magnificent cathedral that is the landmark on the skyline of Florence, became the emblem of Renaissance culture, and now enabled this whole population, this whole culture, to reassert themselves in the world and say, we're the center of European culture. And it migrated. Gothic architecture was secondary, and Renaissance architecture took over, and this was one of the buildings that did that. But they could never have done it if they didn't invent the technologies of building process. Okay, just to make the point, this is not just for old buildings. We still do this today. We're always trying to find a way to do something we can imagine in our heads, but we don't know how to build it. So this is the Sydney Opera House, iconic 20th century building. You note that it took 16 years to build this building. Very few buildings in the middle of the 20th century took 16 years. And that was 16 years of continuous construction. But it was hard. It was hard to build this building. So it started out in the 1950s with a design competition. And they asked, anybody in the world can submit on this design competition. They got like 600 entries from all over the world. Architects sent their drawings to Sydney, and they got a big name jury to come from all over the world and adjudicate on this competition. And the head of the jury was Eero Saarinen. You know, we know about Eero Saarinen. We saw two of his buildings last time, Morrison Stiles Hall and John Deere headquarters. He was probably the most famous architect in the world at that point, or one of the most famous. So he goes down to Sydney, but his flight is late. It's delayed. And this is, you know, in the 1950s, there wasn't regular air transportation like now. And so they had a delay in his flight, and it wasn't like, okay, I'm 5 hours late. He was like 3 days late before he could get there on a flight. And so the rest of the jury was already there, and they had a lot of work to do, so they started going through these 600 entries, and they said, okay, well, we'll filter out all the losers, and we'll send them to the basement, and we'll just keep maybe, I don't know, the 50 or 60 best ones, and then Arrow can help us make the decision of what the winner is. So they went through them all, and they sent a bunch of them to the basement. And then Eero Saarinen comes, and he looks through the ones that they saved, and he said, shit, 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 won't do, not good enough. And, you know, nothing was good enough that they had there. And he said, I think you must have missed something. So he goes down to the basement, and he starts rifling through the rejects. And what he finds is this set of drawings, which were done by this very young architect in Denmark named Jørn Utzon. And that's all there was. They were really lame. They did not fulfill the requirements of the competition for thoroughness or for pricing or for anything like that. They were just a few lame sketches of this building. And Jorn Utzon didn't know how to build it or how, you know, nothing. But Errol Saarinen takes a look at that and he says, oh my God, that is gorgeous. That is going to make one hell of an opera house. So he takes it up to the other guys, and then with his silver tongue, he convinces the rest of the jury that's the winner. They publish it in the newspaper, and everybody just about pees in their pants. It's like, what? You know, this is what we got out of that? What do you do? You know, some people thought it looked like a nun's hat. Some people thought it looked like turtles humping each other. It was lots of jokes made about the building. And they didn't have a clue how to build it. Actually, Jorn Utzon thought it would be thin shell concrete, which is what Errol Saarinen had used at TWA. But the shapes were wrong. They just weren't the right shapes for the structural efficiency of thin shell concrete. So then they started talking about ribs and, you know, made out of steel and made out of concrete, and they got the best engineers in the world, Ove Arup, involved in it in London. And it was big political football. They had to get this thing started, so they poured the foundations. The foundations are in the water. They're in Sydney Harbor. So they're pouring foundations in the water, and they don't even know what they're going to build on the top. And they think of maybe prefabrication. No, that's not going to work. Anyway, they're really, really struggling. It was the very beginning of computers, and Ove Arup did a computer model of how the forces moved through it. And they thought about making all these little unique prefabricated pieces and assembling them up there, but it was just confusing the hell out of everyone, and the precision required for that was probably more than the workers could do. And then one morning, Jorn Utzon is having a grapefruit for breakfast. And he sits there with his knife, and he's cutting the grapefruit, and he realizes that if you cut the grapefruit in exactly the right way, he could get shapes that were kind of like his sails. Not exactly, but kind of like the sails. And the cool thing about that was that means the grapefruit has a uniform radius. So everything could use the same formwork because it's the same radius. And you just place those prefabricated pieces, they'd be even interchangeable there. So he goes back to the engineers and he says, look, I got this idea. Let's change the shape of it and make it all segments of a sphere, but cut in this way so that that uniform radius gives me pretty much the same shapes I had before. So that was the big, big discovery. They did prefabricate all the pieces. They hoisted them all into place, and they created the Sydney Opera House. But again, it was that building process thing that was stumping them. How do we get it all in place, figure it out, make it work? They knew that the form would work, and they actually knew they could build up scaffolding out of steel because now they had steel, and they could pour the whole thing on top of it, but that would have been incredibly expensive. So this prefabrication allowed them to do it in some ways kind of economically. Then they started going to the next step, and he had this lobby where you go and you get high and you look out over Sydney Harbor in the lobby. And it is incredibly dramatic, beautiful, beautiful view. And he wanted to make it all out of glass. No steel, structural glass that would hang out like that and create this lobby. So he found a French manufacturer of glass. Glass does have some structural capability, but it was going to take glass 2 feet thick to do this. Pieces of glass that were 2 feet thick. And Utzon said, excellent, that'll do. And the contractor and everybody else said, you've got to be kidding. We're not doing 2 foot thick glass. Utzon actually got fired from the job. So this is a guy who's put, like at that point, 14 years of his life into this project, moved from Denmark to Australia, moved his whole family down there, worked on this thing for all that time, and he just pushed one step too far, and they fired him. And so the building was completed by other people. They put in the steel that they then used to suspend normal glass from that. Is it as beautiful and dramatic? Maybe not quite so much, but it's damn good. Jorn Utzon would not set foot back in Australia for probably about 40 years. And then finally, on an anniversary of the Opera House, they made peace. They brought him back. He actually did some renovations in the building. But he didn't see the building for 40 years. He never saw it completed until after that point. Many, many building process innovations in this, in the way they formed concrete, in the way they erected the precast concrete, all of that absolutely essential to get the building they got in the end. They did get these shimmery glass tiles from France that give some of that quality he wanted of being shimmery like the water around it. In the end, it was finished, as I said, by other people. The original budget for the Sydney Opera House was $3 million. In the end, it cost $106 million to do the Sydney Opera House. It was a little over budget. But it the way they paid for it was they instigated the Australian lottery, and Australians love to gamble, so nobody was having any pain. They were gambling, and they were getting their opera house. Okay, no Twitter card question today. I ran a little over on time. See you on Tuesday.